War and Remembrance, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with historian Claudia Kuntz of Duke University. She's here to talk about World War II, public monuments, and popular memory.
Western Germany, former Western Germany, it's interesting. There's almost no person at all in any monument. There are abstract expressionist monuments. In fact, you look at them and maybe one looks like a concentration camp chimney, perhaps. And that's in striking contrast with East Germany, which has virtually no monuments to victims of the Holocaust at all. On the contrary, Eastern Europe and Eastern Germany particularly had monuments to the brave anti-fascist fighters of the Second World War.
Historian Claudia Kuntz. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about World War II, public monuments, and popular memory. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. This summer, we find ourselves remembering some important anniversaries in the history of World War II. We've looked back recently to the 50th anniversary of D-Day and the landing of the Allied forces at Normandy. We look forward to the anniversaries of VJ Day and VE Day. But in addition to the ceremonies that we use to commemorate these events, on an ongoing basis, we can turn to artistic monuments for a sense of the interaction of history and public memory. The meeting ground of the two is central to the work of one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Claudia Kuntz is a professor of history at Duke University. Her previous work includes a book entitled Mothers in the Fatherland, a study of women during the Third Reich. She's now working on a book about race, eugenics, and the social politics of Nazi Germany. In recent pieces on World War II, Claudia Kuntz has explored what she calls the fatherland's heritage industry. She's curious about how our understanding of the Nazi past will change in the wake of Germany's political unification. The answers to those questions, she says, will tell us a lot about whether we should regard the new Germany as a threat or a promise. She also notes that the shape of a shared national heritage partly depends on how historical fragments are used in the construction of public memory. Over the next 30 minutes, Claudia Kuntz will talk about these and related issues. She begins her discussion by reflecting on national pride as one of the chief elements in the mixture of history, monuments, and the molding of public memory.
Well, pride is central to public memory in most countries, and if we think back a few years, we think back to the 200th celebrations, the great celebration of 1789 and our own 1776 celebration. So this is the obvious way that people like to look back. But that's not always the case. Think more recently about the Vietnam War Memorial and the controversy that that has generated. And now as we're in the middle of the summer approaching the great 50th anniversaries, we're thinking about a very different memory, the memory of the end of World War II. Mm-hmm. VE Day is ahead of us, VJ Day is ahead of us, D-Day is behind us. How are we going to remember?
Claudia, what's the difference between public memory and popular memory and academic memory? You have to make some distinctions there, don't you?
And they're all fuzzy, of course. But roughly speaking,
that's what makes life interesting for
isn't
you.
It? And then we try to separate it. But sure. Anyway, public memory would be, oh, how people like to think of themselves. And you might see that in a film or in a public opinion poll, certainly in memoirs and novels about the great events of the past. The official memory is what the statesmen, and sometimes women, say about the past. The monuments, the official awards, the tributes, and academic memory is all of the above, plus probably private memory, which is how people secretly like to remember the past.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you, Claudia, back to last spring. The then president of Germany, I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to pronounce this man's name, Richard von
Weizsäcker,
was on the way out of office. And what he did, in effect, was remind the German people that they need to look back at the Holocaust and not simply look back at it, but look back in a particular way. Now, unpack that for me. How did he do it? What was his recommendation?
Well, Richard von Weizsäcker had the great courage, starting about 10 years ago, to tell the Germans, remind the Germans, West Germans at that time, that their public consciousness was rooted in the crimes of the Nazi era.
And he used language like that, crimes.
He did, and he was very controversial at the time. And he said, without coming to terms with the past, we cannot look forward with integrity to a future. Mm-hmm. We must have a national identity that takes into account what our forefathers did. And his own particular father was in the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm. What about Chancellor Kohl? He stands, what, in utter or something of a contrast to the advice of the then president of Germany?
Well, let's remember it was Chancellor Kohl who had the wonderful idea to invite President Reagan to the cemetery at Bitburg and hope that they both sides in the war, could commemorate the victims, who included Germans. And, of course, our president helped out in that, too, by speaking of the soldiers buried at Bitburg as themselves victims of the Nazis. And so mm-hmm. here is the tension in Germany. Kohl has come to represent the memory of victimhood in the Second World War on the part of all Germans, whereas Weizsäcker has paid tribute to the importance of remembering the crimes.
Claudia, what would happen in this country if our politicians decided to build a monument to the people who died in Vietnam, that is to say, the Vietnamese victims of the Vietnam War?
Well, I think those politicians would have a hard time being reelected, don't you? Think about the anger because of the particular shape of the monument to the American soldiers who died in Vietnam. Think about the protest that led to a second monument, more traditional, and now a monument to the women who served.
But this is what has happened in Germany.
No, something worse has happened in Germany. Germany is being asked to pay homage to the victims of their forefathers. Germans themselves, West Germans particularly, are asking, why should I atone for the crimes of my grandfather? Isn't it time that we forget the past, that we allow this past to pass away?
And what do you say to that?
I say the answer is both. That West Germans have considerable cause for pride in the achievements that they've accomplished since 45, and that West Germany, more than any other European government, has taken responsibility for its actions in the Second World War. And I think that should be a model for everybody. So I'm sympathetic with both sides.
When you look, for example, Claudia, in your books, the essays you write, the books that you have written, and in fact the one that you're working on here at the Humanities Center, and you look at the sort of public display of memory, you mentioned, for example, monuments, that kind of thing. Now, we drive down streets and we see them, and we may dismiss them, we may pause and look at them, but they're very finely constructed, aren't they? I mean, they really do represent a lot of deliberate effort. What are we looking at, for instance, when we see these monuments?
Well, first of all, we're looking at statements by politicians, probably, commemorating somebody that politician thinks is important, or statesman. And we don't usually notice them. But one place they really noticed monuments was in Eastern Europe, because those monuments had no resonance at all in their public consciousness. They looked at those statues of Lenin and Marx, etc., and one of the first acts after the Eastern Europe started to crumble was public attacks on public monuments. So when monuments are hated, they're certainly noticed.
You use a phrase here in one of your pieces, the semiotics of place. What is that all about? Unpack that for me.
Well, beneath that fancy phrase is a discussion of what the place means. First of all, on the one level, it's a layered answer to this. What happened there? How is it interpreted? Then, how is that memory both preserved and enshrined in a new message since then? So there are different levels of meaning. When pilgrims in the Middle Ages and afterwards went to the site of a miracle, they experienced that visit on many different levels. And something similar happens, I think, when you go to a concentration camp, even though concentration camps commemorate evil, and obviously pilgrim sites usually commemorate some spiritual high point.
Places of virtue.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What you were going to take me on a kind of a walk, Claudia, that is to say the concentration camp at, pronounce it for me, Buchenwald. Walk me through this and paint me a picture.
Well, first of all, you'd have to get there, Wayne. You'd have to arrive in the train station, and you'd have to look for the bus. And I speak fine. My German is fine. It's not easy to find the bus to Buchenwald. Taxi, of course, will take you there, but it's more expensive. And this is part of the point. I visited most recently after the end of the wall. No one on Buchenwald? Oh, yeah, up there. Now, before the wall, millions of people from everywhere in the Eastern Bloc visited Buchenwald. There were signs everywhere. Now mm-hmm. the signs are gone.
What is this, denial at work?
Forgetting.
The reconceptualizing history?
Yes, because the people who live there say, we live in a wonderful city of Weimar. That's the city of Bach. It's the city of German classics. This is a city of learning and knowledge and high, high culture. We don't want our good name tarnished by that memory up there, 6 kilometers away on the hill.
Well, what happens when you go to this place, Claudia? I mean, I want you to be real personal about this. How do you react?
You get off the bus and you realize you're in the middle of a parking lot that will take probably 1,000 cars, and there are maybe 2 cars left.
Mm.
And then you start walking, and then you realize there are 2 Buchenwalds. The first place that you're directed to is a vast, empty hilltop with huge, huge monuments. A 200-foot bell tower looking out over the valley. And everywhere there are these monuments and oversized architecture, almost as if Albert Speer were designing it. But it hasn't been designed by Albert Speer. This was designed by the commemorative architects in the former East Germany, who built this monument on the hill to anti-fascism. This monument completely overshadows the actual terrain of terror. What is being remembered in the official part of the camp, the oversized part, is the brave communists who led the resistance in Buchenwald and those wonderful Russian soldiers that liberated Buchenwald. Now, of course, Patton's army also participated in liberation of Buchenwald, but you don't see that anywhere commemorated. Then you wander across the terrain and you go to the actual grounds of Buchenwald, silent, sparse, terribly depressing. If you look down, you'll see the outlines of where the barracks used to be. And you see the one building that has been preserved has become an extraordinary and wonderful museum with many, many artifacts, because Buchenwald was the first concentration camp that became a museum in the 1950s. And I urge our listeners to visit Buchenwald and visit it soon, because the whole camp is in the process now of being transformed.
Is it fair to say, Claudia Kuntz, that by remembering these awful chapters in human history, that in some fashion, I mean, the cliche is that we must never forget so that things like this won't happen again. Should we take that seriously at face value?
Yes, and that relates to what will happen at Buchenwald. The citizens in Weimar, the city next door, are angry. They don't want to have West German memory forced on them. They don't want Weizsäcker's memory of guilt for German crimes. More than half of them have been born since 1945. They themselves feel that they have been the victims for almost 40 years of Soviet tyranny. So the Buchenwald they want commemorated is the Buchenwald where former Nazis, after 1945, were locked up pending trial for war crimes. Some of them, of course, were hastily locked up. And, of course, justice was not perfect. So now in the new exhibit room, you see hand-knitted underwear, letters home from former soldiers who were held for trial in the late 1940s. So the East Germans now say, enough of this West German memory. We want our own memory. We want people to commemorate our suffering under the Soviets.
Claudia, we're talking about your essays and books about public memory. We're speaking about World War II. Let's bring the conversation to American shores. Here we have a museum that has just opened up in Washington, D.C. It's the Holocaust Museum. How do you react to that? What is its public function, its place in public memory for the American people?
Well, I can only say what I experienced. I don't know about the American people, although I certainly stood online with lots of American people from all over the country. Mm-hmm. I think that I joined millions of others in just being overwhelmed by that museum, which manages to give you a feeling of place, even though it's in Washington, D.C. Somehow the combination of the architecture, the visuals, the interactive videos give you a sense of having been there, and it's very, very powerful. It's almost like visiting the site of a concentration camp.
Now, to move toward the other end of the spectrum, Claudia, I could ask you about public memory in places like our theme parks, places like Williamsburg. I mean, here we're on a distinctly lighter note compared to what goes on in the Holocaust Museum. Do they really serve the same function, that is to say, to perpetuate the way a people thinks about itself?
Well, Williamsburg is not my idea of what a theme park has become. I know it was one of the first, mm-hmm. but Williamsburg seems relatively benign and relatively historically accurate. But when we talk about theme park where a plastic Abraham Lincoln will deliver the Gettysburg Address on the former site of a battlefield, well, that's something different.
Uh-huh. In other words, you, as a historian, you find something there to condemn rather than praise.
That's right. I feel that one of the power of a landscape often is that it's sparse, to allow your own imagination to fill in the details, not to give you everything prepackaged and plastic.
Claudia, let's talk about public memory and public monuments in terms of our mass culture in this country or in Europe. We could begin, for example, by looking at movies like The Sound of Music and then looking at a movie like Das Boot, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. There are the novels of Herman Woke, the way Americans look back at World War II. How does a professional historian react to efforts like that?
Well, it's a big effort to see all those films because World War II has produced dozens, hundreds of films. Uh-huh. And I noticed just offhand that there's a striking difference between the non-German films and the German films. First of all, of about 70-some films that center on the Holocaust itself, that is, on genocide towards the Jews and other minorities. Of those films, virtually all of those, with maybe three exceptions, are made outside of Germany. Whereas German filmmakers have produced, well over 100 films that are set during the Second World War, and they rarely talk about the Holocaust.
In other words, they don't talk about Nazi doctrine. They don't talk about race hatred, that sort of thing. It's a remembering of a military effort among a people.
Yes, it's a memory of nationalism. It's often set, these films are often set in small towns. And more usual than anything is the salience of women characters. So when filmmakers make films about the Second World War, starting with the film you mentioned, which was a very popular two-film series, there was the Trapp Family 1 and the Trapp Family 2 in mm-hmm. Germany before it became Sound of Music, you find that the major characters, more often than not, are, like Maria, female.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that as a people in the United States or the Germans themselves, Are we remembering World War II properly, accurately, from your standpoint as a historian?
You know, Wayne, as an historian, I'm less and less convinced that there is such a thing as a proper or an accurate memory.
What do you have, a panoply of choices?
That's right. You do, and each one is suited to a particular population. So that the way, for example, a skinhead would remember the Third Reich is quite different and quite appalling than the way I would remember it, uh-huh. or than the way von Weizsäcker would remember it.
But what, you go to the wall, in terms of freedom of speech, that is to say First Amendment issues, you allow for this variety of memories?
Yes.
Rather than imposing
yes.
a monolithic kind
yes.
of thing?
Yes, and in Germany you see what happens when that memory is officially in the Constitution outlawed. The West German Constitution and now the German Constitution outlaw fascism, fascist symbols, swastikas, and particular hate songs. Mm-hmm. And now, instead of costing just $8 or $9, an outlawed fascist hate song can sometimes cost on the black market $20 or $30, and they're becoming more and more popular. So it's not just out of idealism that I'm in favor of free speech, but also for pragmatic political reasons.
Well, now, a historian might make some fine distinctions along these lines, but in mass culture, we don't often make those distinctions, and it looks as though the worst in human nature is coming to the fore again. Should we just sort of condescend to these skinheads and dismiss them, therefore?
No, I think that we need to launch very important and effective counter-media presentations, like the showing of Schindler's List with a special teacher in Oakland, California, to the group of students who laughed when they saw it on Martin Luther King Day. Mm. I think that this alerts us to the importance of our taking the media seriously and using it effectively.
Claudia Kuntz, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What are you working on at the National Humanities Center? You're looking back at World War II. You got three or four very large terms at work in your title. How about them?
Well, the large terms are, well, I suppose Nazi and Third Reich is itself pretty big. And then the other terms are race, eugenics, and gender. Mm-hmm. And I am stopping the clock in about 1936 to 1939, and I am examining very closely the propaganda that was used by the Nazi state to deepen racial consciousness, as they called it, gender consciousness, as I think we would call it, and to inspire a drive for eugenic purity, racial purity, not just by eliminating the outsiders, so-called, but by ridding the master race of its so-called damaged genes. And so I'm, instead of looking at that as just a step on the way to the Holocaust and going over it quickly as the introduction to a book, I'm stopping the clock and looking at how effective it was among the general public opinion, how effective it was in the medical community, and how the bureaucracy reacted to popular opinion. We always think, well, there is no popular opinion in a fascist country. They have no freedom. But that's not true at all.
Well, people think for themselves. They talk.
Right.
There are networks, grapevines. Right. There's gossip, if nothing else.
And for us working in German history, it's absolutely wonderful that they also had a secret police and mood monitors everywhere, because they needed to fine-tune their propaganda. Uh-huh. They needed to know what could not be made public. They needed a popular opinion feedback. So I'm working with those sources.
It occurs to me to ask you about one of the figures in this very dark chapter in human history, World War II, and that is Joseph Goebbels. You have written, you wrote a review about a biography of Goebbels. I remember reading that here is a man who was characterized as a creature of the void. That's a phrase that has always stayed with me. Do you come to it, Claudia, as a historian, and look at that in political terms or moral terms?
I look at that in moral and political terms. For Goebbels, they were all the same. Hmm. And I would say, yes, Goebbels may have been a creature of the void, but he was a creature that the void, for whom the void was filled with hatred. This was a man capable of massive hatred, and probably only capable of love towards his leader, Hitler. Because of his own void, he could hear what people wanted to hear. And so he could therefore speak to them, mobilize their hatreds, give voice to inchoate feelings that they may have been barely conscious of. Mm-hmm. And certainly you can't blame the German people for this kind of evil. By all means, remember, the Germans never voted in a majority for for the Nazi regime.
Well, I want to make it clear. I was not implying that the German people are somehow essentially different than the rest of the people on the planet. What I was trying to get at here is how does it happen that the German people would respond to leadership like that? That's a very big order. Do you want to reflect on that for me?
Well, Wayne, I think I could answer that by making an even bigger answer, and that is, look at the disorganized chaos in Eastern Europe today. And look at the way hatred is proving powerful enough to mobilize people when ideals of goodness and virtue just aren't.
And this is what was going on in the late 30s.
It certainly was.
Uh-huh. As you look back at World War II and the horror, the enormity of Nazi Germany, do you think of this as a kind of unique phenomenon in human history? The question that underscores this entire conversation is, can it happen again? How do you react to that sort of an inquiry?
Well, let me react by saying there are two its. It, on one level, is genocide. Can people be killed simply because of their ethnic, supposedly racial identity? And the answer to that is absolutely. With horror, we see it. What we once thought was forever past. We see it even in Western Europe. We see it in former Yugoslavia. The other it is the mechanized mass murder using high-tech methods of a highly industrialized society. That's what I don't think will happen again. I think it sounds strange to say, but at the end of the second millennium, I would predict that we're going to see more primitive kinds of genocide in the future.
Claudia Kuntz is a professor of history at Duke University. She recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a new book about race, eugenics, and gender in the social politics of Nazi Germany. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this discussion. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian Claudia Kuntz of Duke University. For an audio tape of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 719. That's program number 719, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Next week on Soundings, join me for another conversation about World War II and European culture. Historian Mark Mazower of the University of Sussex will be here to talk about his book on the Nazi occupation of Greece. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.